Now a team leader, Alex Albon is no longer looking in his mirrors.
When I spoke to you last, a lot of it's just trying to survive, trying to get another contract, trying to get an extension or whatever it was back then. Now it's more in a position where I feel comfortable. You're never truly comfortable, but more about being that team player more than having to be selfish to fight for my career.
In 2023, Alex drove Williams to their best season in 6 years. He's proven he belongs in Formula One. So what does he want to achieve both this year and beyond?
I won't deny and say there are opportunities around. You know, there is a very fluid driver market right now, and I think it's exciting. It's moving around. You're going to have to wait and see, but I love being a part of this team. I love this kind of building the team around, and this upwards progress that we're on is very exciting. I'm here to go racing, and then that's it.
Hello and welcome to F1 Beyond the Grid with me, Tom Clarkson. Given all the highs and lows he's endured in Formula One, it's hard to believe that Alex Albon is actually one of the least experienced drivers on the grid. He's been promoted and demoted by Red Bull Racing. He's scored podiums, he's been teammate to Max Verstappen, and in 2021, he had to watch from the sidelines as a reserve driver. But the Alex Albon I speak to now is confident and calm. Far from just surviving, Alex is thriving as he and Williams embark on their third season together. His 27 points last year helped the team climb from last in 2022 to P7 in 2023, and team principal James Vowles is determined to build the team around him. Throw in more pets and more passions, and clearly a lot has changed in the 2 years since our last proper catch-up on F1 Beyond the Grid. Alex talks about the impact that playing golf has had on his mentality, the fascinating way in which his fitness changes during the season, and why self-care has become a number one priority. He also tells me how Williams have been pushed to their absolute limits in pursuit of progress, and whether he'd prefer to be under more pressure from teammate Logan Sargeant. Plus, I ask Alex if he can name all 13 of his cats and what the wide-open driver market could mean for his future. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Alex, it's great to see you again. How are you?
Good, thank you. How are you?
Well, I'm overjoyed that you've allowed us into your driver room. This is like your prep area.
Don't worry, I didn't allow you. Content allowed you. No, of course you're welcome here. This is basically not as glamorous as I think you would expect. I don't know what you had in mind.
It's smaller.
Normally, or sometimes depends how much time the team have before races. For example, we only have a week here, but sometimes I'll carpet it, make it feel a bit more homely. Sometimes we'll have a sofa, but we are on stools. So yes, obviously my lovely suits.
Five sets of overalls. Is that one for each on-track session?
That sounds like I'm a diva, but trust me, there are drivers that have a new suit a session. So we're not one of them. The problem is we obviously have a white suit, so, and the listeners can't see this, but...
Shows the dirt.
Weirdly, my bum has remained pretty clean. Normally, you get dirty marks around your posterior.
Well, depends how many fast corners there are.
Yeah. So come back after the FP1, you're going to see a bit. But it is quite bad, and white suits aren't that smart. But they look good, so that's fine.
Three helmets behind you. How many helmets do you get through in a season?
We're all contracted, so we all have different deals with helmet suppliers. Generally speaking, there's a number they have in mind. It's you know, I don't know, maybe I'm low. I bet you I'm lower than Lewis. But I have about 16, 17 helmets a year. I rarely even use that many. It's hard to use that many helmets. And you don't really need it as well, because actually it's nicer to use... used helmets, because they soften up a little bit around your cheeks and your head, so it feels more comfortable, like a pair of jeans. But otherwise, yes, I have 16. Sometimes I go more, depends how adventurous I am with one-off designs and all that kind of thing. But we tend to have three. You need three on rotation every week.
That's great intel, it's really is good to see you. And I was wondering whether you might have developed an American accent over the winter. Because you spent so much time in the US.
Yes, yeah, I do. I like it there. It's my girlfriend's from LA, so it's a little bit easier, and it makes more sense to go over there, especially when Europe and the UK, more than anything, is exceptionally cold. So it's nice to go out to LA. City LA is a bit... I'm not a big fan, but the
Where
suburbs...
Where do you hang out then?
More towards the north side, so Calabasas. It's called Westlake, if people know that area. But in the mountains, more towards Malibu area. So it's beautiful, amazing cycling roads and amazing facilities, running tracks. In America, the sports is so well done. You know, you speak to the high schools or the colleges and they give you some privileges. So it's very nice.
And did you get any downtime?
I mean, that is kind of downtime. It sounds weird to say, but when we are in the middle of training camp, that's the time away from racing. We're kind of doing our own thing, have our routine. My girlfriend, she plays golf. So
and
we're kind
golf.
Of...
We saw you in the Netflix Cup last year.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. It was the day before the Netflix Cup, I had to practice. My girlfriend's coach is actually based in Las Vegas, so it was perfect. So I did a session with him. We went to a really nice course. It's called Shadow Creek. And it's like a very posh, very exclusive course. And I couldn't hit the ball. Literally missed every single
shot. And
this
is the day before.
This is the day before. I couldn't. I was shanking it. You know, I was just thinking in my head, okay, there's going to be a crowd behind us, around us. I am going to kill someone. luckily.
You're overthinking it is what you're doing.
I was overthinking it. And... the coach said, don't worry, your clubs are a bit short. We'll get you some better clubs and you'll be fine tomorrow. I didn't believe him because why would you? It doesn't really help. But it did. Or maybe it was just that I needed that little bit more confidence. That was the best I played for a long time. And I was glad to be able to do it in front of camera, in front of my girlfriend, of course, and in front of the professionals. Because, you know, the first hole, it was a scramble. So you take the best ball. I hit my ball closer than the pros. It was a par three. That's my takeaway. That's my claim to fame.
So, that was before you fell over.
Yeah.
Sorry. I didn't want
to. You got me. Yeah, yeah. Yes. I wasn't going to mention it, but okay, fine. Let's go in.
It's a weird sport, golf. The more I play, the worse I get.
That's interesting.
Explain that to me. I
have the same kind of thing. When I take a long break, my first game back, I think it's because you don't overthink it. Once you start to try to pick up habits, you're trying to remember why you played well that one day. Yeah. And then you're trying to, you know, you're in that vicious circle. I actually think, real talk now, golf is very good to teach you mentally how to approach many things in life. I think it's a great lesson because it's so easy to get over frustrated in golf. It's so easy to think too much. It's so easy.
Sounds quite like Formula One, really.
It is. Exactly that. It has good life lessons and it's... As I've started playing golf, I've definitely learned to not be as wound up about playing badly and things like that. I always just play golf now to have a good time, which makes a big difference. But in the beginning, you're too competitive.
I did also see that you've been charging around in Singer 911 Porsches.
I have. I wish it was mine.
It's not. It wasn't.
It is not mine.
I was going to say.
People thought it was mine. People thought I had two. I said, with all due respect, I would need to negotiate a little bit more with James Vowles to be able to afford two.
Alex,
never
for people who don't know,
yeah.
The Singer 911s are vintage Porsches.
Vintage Porsches. They're called resto mods. That's the official term.
Specced up beautifully. And they're now worth up to, what, $2 million?
Yes, you can. So actually, shameless Williams plug, but Williams, there's a special edition of the Singer. So they have one built in America. It's it takes, I don't know how long it takes, a year and a half, 2 years for them to build them. Most likely completely wrong in what I'm saying, but they are around $1 million. And then they have this thing called the DLS, which is a...
Is that the lightweight?
It's a lightweight edition. Yeah, you know a bit. Williams did their engines. They
Didn't
did a collaboration and the engine is very good. So Williams, the WAE, Williams Advanced Engineering, which was very much involved in that project. And them cars are built in the UK. And them ones, they can go over $3 million.
What are they to drive?
So that's why I don't have one. Very simple.
What do they like to drive? Do you feel like you're driving something that's old? Or are they
No.
Really
so
tight?
I drove the original through the kind of canyon roads around LA. Very raw. So you get this feeling like you have this loud engine in behind you. You feel very connected to the road. Then on the DLS, that's a different ballgame. That is really special. It has double wishbone suspension. Again, don't quote me on this, I could be totally wrong, but the way it rides curbs, I drove it on a track in it's called Thermal, which is near LA. Imagine a golf course, exclusive golf course, but instead of a golf course, it's a racing track. So you pay a membership fee to have a house on the property. And then once you pay that membership fee, you have unlimited, you have a track.
Laps.
You have
a track. Your own private track.
You have
track.
Your own private track.
Wow. So how did you get on it?
The guy who owned the DLS, so not mine.
Has a membership.
Has a membership. He has a house there. And we were just driving around. It was for charity. So some very kind gentleman donated some money for me to take him around. And so, yeah.
And how important was it for you to get some downtime at the end of a long and intense Formula One season? I remember you being quite ill in Abu Dhabi, actually.
Yes, I got sick. I had a throat infection also after Abu Dhabi. So it meant my winter training was coming from quite far down in terms of fitness. I really had to work quite hard to get it.
But did you do nothing after Abu?
No, so I went straight into a training camp. I wanted to start training before Christmas because I felt so tired, and sometimes just doing nothing is not good, so you want to get your body moving. I wanted to build a good amount of fitness, better than how I finished in Abu Dhabi, just to make sure once I go over Christmas and New Year, which everyone takes off, there was less work to do when I got back. Because we had a weirdly long break, didn't we? We finished Abu Dhabi early December, so you kind of spend a month twiddling your thumbs a bit. So I did a bit of a training camp. I was about 2.5 kilos down from race one. So I lost, over the year, about 2.5 kilos of muscle.
That is all muscle.
That's all muscle. Gone. So I had to get that back up. And then your fitness, you know, your cardiovascular system, it really does, your VO2 really does start to take a hit, just because you can't. Can you imagine when we do triple headers, when we're going in the hotels and airports and whatnot, and now that marketing are here, the marketing stuff, you at best get one day of training before you go into your next race, and then one day of training, and then you go into your next race. So on a Monday or a Tuesday after a race weekend, that's your time to train. It's not much.
But I'm interested, this weight loss over the year, did it affect you in races later on?
With all the training you do, you actually arrive, at least for me, maybe some people are different, I arrive at race one as fitter than I do for the rest of the year, because I've spent all that time to just get out there and do my training. So you get race fit, but there's also general fitness, so your race fitness gets up, so your neck gets stronger, your core gets stronger. But then on the other side, your general fitness, your cardio and everything starts to drop, and your muscle mass starts to drop, so you start to lose in other areas. And I think the jet lag is actually a huge one, which people possibly don't consider as well.
All right, this is an interesting topic given where we're going next week.
Yes.
How are you going to combat
where
the jet lag
week?
In Australia?
I leave on Saturday. So,
right. So that gets you in Sunday, does it?
Gets me in Sunday. So if I, my plan right now is I will fly back from, as we are in Jeddah, Sunday night. Monday is trip to the dentist in London. And then Tuesday, Wednesday will be sim. Thursday, we have a marketing day with Golf, one of our sponsors. And then Friday, a session with my trainer, and then fly Saturday.
And then when you hit the ground in Australia, how do you combat the jet lag?
So we do it before. We even do it before we start flying out. So as we start to move around, we start doing our normal things. But, you know, light's a big thing. So blocking light, shades. I'm not so big on melatonin. I don't really like the sleeping stuff. It feels unnatural to me. So I use cherry extract. It's like a natural sedative. So that works pretty well.
What, you take that just before bedtime?
Before bedtime, try and get earlier. I don't actually know Australia yet, but my trainer, we have a sleep doctor, and they basically tell us what to do. How you eat, very important, how you sleep and hydrate, and as I said, exposure to light, caffeine, so the way you take coffee, or I use coffee, it all plays a big part.
And how does it affect you in the car?
I think the main thing is you can imagine what we're doing already requires a lot of concentration, and your reflexes, the coordination with your engineer speaking to you on the radio, especially when we go to these street tracks. So Melbourne's going to be one of them. And you just don't feel like you're optimal. You can tell that you're not as sharp as you want to be. And that's the worst.
Is that
feeling
reflected in the stopwatch or not?
I don't know, to be honest. I imagine it is. And so there is a huge effort. And I think one of the biggest things I've realized as I've spent time in Formula One is really putting yourself first, really taking care of yourself. I think as the schedule gets busier and busier, especially the way that we treat our bodies and treat our time has been so important. So, you know, really prioritizing your sleep, your training, which of course we're Formula One drivers. We're supposed to do all these events and do what you know, simulator work and whatever. So it is a balance, but being good at that management, it takes up most of my days when I'm not driving the car, trying to be as organized as possible.
Well, it's been 2 years since you were last on the pod. Yes. And I was going to say, what is the biggest lesson you've learned in that time? Have you just revealed it?
Self-care for sure is one of them. And generally speaking, it's more just being about confidence, and 2 years is 2 years of life maturing. So, you know, speaking with the team and understanding how to lead a team and how to develop a team and try and get the car into a better place. That's been most of the work I've done since our last podcast. When I spoke to you last, a lot of it's just trying to survive, trying to get another contract, trying to get an extension or whatever it was back then. Now it's more in a position where I feel comfortable. You're never truly comfortable, but more about being that team player more than having to be selfish to fight for my career.
We all know that teamwork is a huge part of Formula One, but it's also the key to success in most industries and workplaces. So if you're on the hunt for the perfect addition to your team, let Indeed do the hard work for you. With over 350 million global monthly visitors, Indeed is not just a job search website, it's your ultimate hiring partner. Its powerful matching engine ensures you find top quality candidates quickly, so you can get back to what matters most, growing your business. I've known people that have been in the same position as you, and I've seen how overwhelming the hiring process can be. And I can't help but think that if they'd known about Indeed back then, it would have saved so much time and energy. So say goodbye to the endless work of scheduling interviews, screening resumes, and managing communication. Indeed streamlines the entire hiring process for you, allowing you to connect with potential hires faster than ever before. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites. And don't just take my word for it, experience the difference for yourself. With over 140 million qualifications and preferences analyzed daily, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning and evolving to meet your specific hiring needs. The more you use Indeed, the better it gets at finding the perfect fit for your team. So join the ranks of over 3.5 million businesses worldwide who trust Indeed to help them hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/grid. Just go to Indeed.com/grid right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/grid. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Laurent Mekies was on the pod last week, and he said drivers can get quicker every year.
Yeah.
Whereas I'd always had the belief that the speed isn't what changes. It's maybe your racecraft and your
things
wrapped around it. But he actually believes you can get faster. Do you?
I agree. I definitely think that's the case. At least for me, what I've found is my speed becomes quicker because I know more and more what I want in the car, and I know how to get it. So I know how to set up a car. I know how to get the car into a good window. I know how to, if the tires in qualifying or in the race are going a certain direction, not good, let's say, generally I know how to fix it. I know what areas I need to improve on. So the experience really brings together an overall understanding of what you need, what suits your driving style, but also what are the limits of the car. Some bits you can't fix. Some bits you have to just ignore and focus on some other areas of the car. You know, there might be a characteristical issue in the car that you could spend all day working on it, fix it, but you've made 10 other things worse. So this kind of appreciation for getting lap time out of the car and understanding of it has really gone a long way for me. And I think that's one of the biggest things I've learned.
And you mentioned leading the team. That's something that James Vowles said when he was on the pod as well, that he wants to build Williams around you. Have you felt that? in the last 18 months?
I would definitely say I'm far more involved now than I was before.
But in decisions beyond how to make the car go faster in qualifying? I mean, in terms of structural decisions within the team, things like that?
You know, I'm not there saying we need to do this or this, because that's James's job. And I think James sees it much clearer than I do. And his experience at Mercedes and whatnot has really helped him know what we need. And for me, it's more, I've seen these areas and there's no kind of stone that has been left untouched that I didn't think need fixing, and James has already turned it over. So I feel like we've, you know, in terms of an understanding of what the team needs to do to be a better top field team, we know there's not this discussion of where is it, what are we looking for. We know what it is, but it will take time.
But how hard is it to get that?
It is hard. And I think every year that goes on, especially when we're coming into this year, you see, we've talked a lot about our car, how we've really changed the philosophy and the DNA of the car, and we've really gone about it a different way. There are some things we have improved massively to last year, but it has definitely stretched the team. It's really pushed it to its limits, and the cracks show in areas, and it's interesting to see how, you know, especially for James, it's oh, myself as well, just because I want the team to be better and we want to be fighting, but them areas are where we need to improve. We've got a good foundation now. It's going to take time. It really is, to be one of them teams fighting for the podiums.
But, you know, you have raced for a top team in Red Bull.
Yeah.
What are the fundamental differences? Okay, and budget is obviously one. I get that.
Yeah, it's a well-oiled machine, Red Bull. I think there aren't any real weak points. I mean, even at my time at Red Bull 4 years ago, 5 years ago, it was still a well-oiled machine, and they've only just made steps from then. When I had my time at Red Bull, you can just see that, you know, everyone's doing their job, everyone's at the very top of their game. And Williams, we do some things very well, some things we need to improve on. You know, it's not as refined, but it's still in its growing phase. And I think that's really the biggest difference. The desire and the passion, that's clearly there, and that's always been there at Williams.
Do you feel, what are you, you're 27 now?
27, yeah, getting old. Almost 28.
Yes, it's end of March, isn't it?
This might come out when I'm 28.
And what, 80-odd Grand Prix under your belt. Do you feel you're hitting your peak now?
It's weird, because I saw a statistic the other day, and I thought I must have been one of the more experienced drivers or midfield. But actually, you take away Logan, Joe, and Oscar, I'm going to miss someone else. I think I'm joint with Yuki, but I'm joint fourth least experienced driver, which is weird to say as a statistic, but I feel much more than that. And as you said, when you take into account 4 years of experience, I still think, like what you said about Laurent, I think there's always more to come. I don't think it just stops now. You still explore, you still find things with your driving or with things, or let's say set up ideas and philosophies that you figure out. There's still more to come. There's always more to
come. Do you think that you out-qualified Logan at every race last year. If you were under more pressure from your teammate, do you think your rate of improvement would be faster?
Tricky question. Different drivers respond very differently. So I think some drivers need that kind of prod. Other drivers actually are the totally opposite. If they can be in a happy space, that's where they perform the best. For me, it's somewhere in the middle. I think what I've learned is the more I can just focus and be in the present and not worry about the other side and that kind of thing, that's how I perform the best. But at the same time, I love that kind of that fight. I enjoy the competition. So yeah, it's somewhere in between.
Did you learn more when you had Max Verstappen and Danny Kvyat next to you than you do having Logan Sargeant next to you?
Again, tough question. I would say, of course, yes, because I was also so inexperienced to start with. So the rate of learning and what I had to learn and what there was to learn was so much more when I started Formula One than what it is now. There's still things I'm learning, of course, but it was such an open world, an unexplored world back when I first was in Formula One. So in that sense, yes. My roles have changed, though. So more than anything, if you take teammates aside, it's more, I'm enjoying, with this new car, for example, exploring different setups, doing different things. And, you know, I think, especially right now, the dynamic within the team, we're just pushing the envelope. And because I have the experience and I think also confidence to just try things during a weekend and of course always come back if it doesn't work out. But that side has changed. Whereas I think when I was more, you know, up against Max and Danny, it was more just about give me the car that, that the other guy's driving and I'll get up to speed, and I need to figure it out with my driving and my tools, you know, what we're doing on the steering wheel, where to improve. And I know I can do it. So there's much more time spent exploring.
I feel that the Alex I'm talking to now would have dealt with that part of your Formula One career so differently if it were to happen now.
It is, but that's hindsight. I think hindsight's beautiful.
And experience.
It is, and I wouldn't be where I am now if I didn't go through the time. So it would always, you know, always goes back. But I do think maybe people forget that I only spent 6 months in Toro Rosso before I got to the big team, and there was still quite a big gap in my maturity and understanding of F1 before I...
Huge.
It was. Yeah. It was people over time have really got an understanding of how tough it is to be a rookie. I think teams give their drivers more time as well as a result. But on the same kind of negative spiral, it's why teams are also so hesitant to have rookies in their teams. So it is a big jump, and it's getting a bigger jump now just because these cars, I find, they're tricky to drive. They're much harder than they were back in 2017.
Why? Where's the lap time in these cars?
The cars are stiff. They're low. That's where you get the downforce. The cars move around much more. Every bump you feel, you have to have true confidence in the cars now, because when they are jumping around in the middle of a corner...
More like karting.
Exactly. Yeah. Actually, it feels like it's definitely taken a step back in terms of refinement, and it actually starts to feel, you know, you've got to wrestle these things. So that side of things has played a much bigger part in, I think, getting lap time out of the cars. And as a consequence, they're much easier to make mistakes. I think, you know, when you run a stiff car and it's edgy and these cars, they're still very wind dependent, the normal kind of things, it adds another layer to make it more difficult to drive.
What about the FW46? Talking about it being wind dependent, that was...
Yeah.
Something that the team's cars have suffered from quite a lot in recent years,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes.
Is it still an issue?
It's interesting. So Bahrain was always a bad track for us.
Because it's windy. Yeah.
And the corners don't suit us. And what we found last week was just how much better the car is at certain wind angles. I always find wind is more of a balance amplifier. So let's say you have a corner where you have front locking or understeer, that wind will only make it worse. And for the same reason, if you have a bit of oversteer here and there, that wind's only going to make it worse. So you're just pulling the car apart. It kind of really highlights issues in the car. The 45 had a lot of issues. When the wind was behind us, it was a nightmare. And we've seen massive steps for this year. The only thing I would say to that is everyone's made a step. So that midfield is quite frustrating because, I mean, the top teams have made a step. Bottom midfield teams have made an even bigger step, but they've all made the same step. So
the gaps between teams feel quite similar.
Yeah, exactly. And it's all relative. So we kind of improved, you know, 6, 7, 8 tenths to last year. Massive jumps and race pace, even more massive steps. You look around your shoulder and it's the same people you're fighting for the same positions.
So when you qualify, what was it, 13? You know, was it a good lap? Were you thinking that is our true position?
It is.
Our true position.
I was happy with the lap. I think there's always, call it race one rust, there's a little bit you can find, but I think that's it'll be unfair to say every driver drove a perfect lap. I think there's always a bit from everyone. But you know, what was it? Q1 was it 8 tenths or a second or just over a second covering the whole field. Now it's more like you make a little mistake and you think that's two positions.
But it's good for the drivers because there's even more emphasis on you guys.
It is.
To not make mistakes and the good guys will shine.
That's where F1's going. In some ways, it's a bit of a shame to see comments about Max and it being a boring season, because it's totally not that, at least from my perspective, because you take him out of the equation, you have one of the best grids, the best field, the tightest grids ever in Formula One. And even if you include Max, it's still the tightest field in Formula One. So,
well, let's not forget that Charles Leclerc actually did the fastest qualifying lap last weekend.
Exactly.
In Q2.
It's hard because it's the leader, so everyone focuses on the leader. But the racing at the back is so intense. We pitted two laps too late in Bahrain during the race, and we lost six positions. Went from 11th and finished 15th. So it's tight.
But what about the development of this car? Do you feel there's more scope than there was last year?
There is. So in our heads, without exposing too much, we've got a very good platform. We know where the lap time is. Some of it is achievable, some of it isn't, more for next year, which obviously is a bit painful to say because it's far away, but that's just the way it is. We have a good foundation, as I said, and we've got some updates coming, but I'll say it again, in the end, everyone does. You're only trying to outperform and overachieve compared to the others. We know we've got lap time hiding in the car. Let's see what the others have.
Have you enjoyed bouncing ideas off Pat Fry?
Yeah, he's been great. I really enjoyed Pat. We have these meetings Monday after every race, and it's just kind of like a shoot your SHIT. Everyone kind of has a bit of a chat around the areas we need to focus on and whatever. And obviously, Pat has so much experience, and it's very interesting to see the areas we need to work in as a team, because he's coming from also a very organizational background. So when he talks, he's not technically always talking about performance, but he's just talking about how can we be more efficient as a team. And when we look at the areas for us to improve, that's really our main areas. So yeah, you know, some things he will say are positive, and there are others which he says we need work to do.
So, two podiums to your name already.
Yes.
Is it too big an ask for 2024?
We need something.
Well, Max and Lewis take each other out. And then
Max and Lewis take each other out. Charles and Lewis. Oh, no. At that point, we'll have Charles and Carlos.
Yeah.
We'll get a few of them out. And then we can.
So it would need exceptional circumstances.
It would need something, yeah. But there's always two races, I think, in the year that happens, and you just got to be in the right place at the right spot, and you can have a chance. You know, look at Esteban in Hungary, for example. So there's always a chance.
Right, but look at the Alpines last year with Esteban's podium in Monaco, or Pierre in Zandvoort, I think it was.
It is exactly. Maybe
actually, just talking about those results last year. I mean, what was it? You qualified fourth.
In Zandvoort.
In Zandvoort.
Yeah, there you go. And we were genuinely running fourth or fifth for most of the race. We didn't take the gamble like other people did that race with the tyres. If you remember, it was raining, drying, and all these kind of things. We couldn't, because we were in such a good position. We thought, we've got to just play it safe. We've got to stay out. But that's very true. You know, we're not far away, and it's only going to take a little bit for us to get there. So let's hope for a podium. I'm not sure it will come, but I'll remain optimistic.
Yeah, and of course, it's the longest season in the history of Formula One. And yes. I know a lot of people watching, listening to this, will be going, what happens to the pets?
How's the pets?
While you're
away.
Don't
worry, I have four siblings and a mum who take a lot of care with the pets. So don't worry, they are fed more than well. They are definitely living a happy life.
What's the latest count? Because they've got their own Instagram account.
I always forget, but I believe it's 13 cats.
Albon_pets.
Albon underscore, please give it a follow. Albon_pets. We got 13 cats.
But can I stop you
there?
Two horses. Why 13 cats? I mean, I love cats, but
so there's 13? Always this thing, and I don't know if anyone can resonate with this. Let's say we want a cat. Fine. We've already got too many cats at home, but whatever. There might be a reason for it. Normally the reason is, you know, there's a litter and they're struggling to sell them, or you know, they don't know what to do with them. Like, okay, first person they call
all the local dealer.
Exactly. All breeders.
Alex will have one.
Alex Albon will take one. So they call up and they say, listen, we've got an issue, blah, blah, blah. What often happens is my sisters and my mom will go to collect, you know, either a stray cat or whatever it may be. Somehow, going in to get one, when they come home, there's three or four. And it's like, where have these come from? And that's happened three times. In some ways, supposed to only have three and then ended up with 10. Because there was one litter, we took four. We're supposed to come with one and we took four. So there's, we got one called, there's giraffe, hippo.
Can you name all 13 cats?
Okay. I got quizzed this the other day and I don't.
African
the problem
animals.
Is I'm not there enough, so I really struggled. Because obviously a lot of them are brothers and sisters. It's really hard to know which one's which. So we've got Armani, Gucci, Prada, and Lucky. Lucky is just, I don't know why Lucky, but they were kind of a group. And then we have Goose and Duck. That's 5, 6. Then Hugo, for Hugo Boss, that's 7. And then there is a giraffe, hippo. Oh, God.
Lion.
No, not lion. I'm going to get killed for not knowing this. And then there's sushi. Then we have a dog called Otty. And then we have two horses.
I thought, and there's Stan.
If you really want to know, each cat has numerous names.
Oh, okay.
So Amani is called Amani Mumu and Adja. And then for someone like Stan, so I call him Stan. Some of my other sisters call him Hugo. So can you see, there's this whole conflict. It is very confusing. Right. I'm sure the cats have
no idea
what
they're called. But in a nutshell, it's 13 cats, two horses,
and a dog.
And a dog.
Yes. So.
And then Stan made some shoes, didn't he? Are you wearing them now?
I am wearing, these are custom one of ones, but I do have shoes. I'm going to have some shoes this year, so make sure. I see a lot of drivers releasing their merch already. Hold on to your money and spend it on mine.
Actually, Alex, I was impressed the way you got Fernando Alonso to wear a pair in Singapore.
Fernando has to be one of the best guys ever, because I've told this story before, but I didn't want to leapfrog and leech on the drivers and say, hey, you know, can you wear my stuff, whatever. I was like, if they want some, sure, of course, I'll give it to them. And so Yuki asked, no problem. And then we were coming out of driver's briefing, and Fernando was like, oh, I like your shoes. Can you get me one? And I was like, yeah, you bet you can. So I spoke to my manager. I was like, you got to get Fernando a pair of shoes. We had a pop-up store in Singapore. So he ran down to the pop-up store, got a pair for him, brought them back. And you know, he's a Hugo Boss ambassador. You know, he does wear his
Hugo's. The team is, I think.
The team is. I think he looks like he has a personal deal with them, whatever it is. So he does wear Hugo Boss shoes. And then on Sunday for the race weekend, there he is with Alex Albon Athletics.
It was so cool.
It was very cool of him and very nice of him. I think he's very in with the kids. Like, you know, we're not that young, you know, especially because he's in Monaco now. A lot of the guys, we get on well with him. And
There's the paddle matches.
There's the paddle matches, and he's a good laugh.
I did see, actually, I was playing paddle on the Sunday after the Bahrain Grand Prix, and he was there as well. I said, oh, I hear you're decent at paddle. And he went, not so much me being good, it's more the other drivers being so good.
I was speaking to Lando the other day, because I think he played with, there was a grouping of them with Max and someone else, I can't remember. Lando said, first 10 minutes, he was kind of late. He got up late and strolled out of bed and teamed up with Fernando. Better maybe Lando tells the story, but basically said, he was so serious. Like, the most competitive man you could ever meet. You know, he was just that guy, like, are you in it or not, kind of thing. Which I just thought is super cool. Because
you have to sharpen up when you're with him, don't you?
He lives and breathes competition. And you see it. You see it in everything he does. Yeah.
Well, Alex, it has been brilliant to chat. Can you just clarify one thing for us before you go? Which is 2025.
Yes.
Okay. There's going to be so much movement in the driver market. What's the sitch with you and Williams?
It's something that we know. Let's say it like that.
We're going to have to wait a bit longer.
You're going to have to wait and see. Okay. But, you know, on my side, I'm totally focused on the team. I feel like, I know it sounds generic, but it is very true that I love being a part of this team. I love, you know, what we spoke about earlier, this kind of building the team around and this progress, that this upwards progress that we're on is very exciting. I won't deny and say there are opportunities around. You know, there is a very fluid driver market right now, and I think it's exciting. It's moving around. But my focus and my entire time is put on the team, and I'm here to go racing, and that's it.
Well, look, good luck with everything. Hope that podium comes your way. New for this year, some quick fire questions to end.
Yes.
Very quickly. What else are you good at?
What else am I good at? Oof. Okay.
Collecting pets.
Apart from pets, I'm not good at anything else than racing. And even then, it's questionable. But let's say...
It's not questionable. Stop being modest.
Photography. I enjoy photography. I enjoy cooking, but I'm not good at cooking. More like sweet things than savory things. I'm not good at golf. That's it. I'm very limited. Very limited.
Which racing driver would you want to be stuck in a lift with?
No one who has any bowel issues. I think it depends how long, but I wouldn't want someone who's just talking all the time, just someone quiet. So maybe like a Valtteri, just keep it quiet.
Who would play you in a film?
I don't think anyone has a face like mine. You know what I mean? Like, I've got quite a not unique face, but I always have thought of Jackie Chan, just because, why not? You can put a few backflips in it as well.
Who's the coolest person in your address book?
I got, again, boring. It's my pets, my girlfriend, and that's me. And of course, the racing drivers. So I'm well out of the limelight. You know, I'm not the guy to go to these fashion events or concerts. So coolest. Well, it's coolest. It's not most famous.
Yeah, coolest.
Okay, interesting.
Stan.
Sorry to all my anyone who knows me. I've dissed all of you because none of you are cool. Stan, yeah, Stan has his own phone. No, I'm joking. He doesn't. But
and look, final one. Who would be your first guest if you hosted a podcast?
That's a good question. Let's have a think. Valentino Rossi. Yes, definitely.
Brilliant.
Alex, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Great. Alex is very relaxed, isn't he? And he oozes confidence. I love catching up with him because not only is he great company, he offers plenty of insight. What he was saying about weight loss during the season, I found fascinating. And then there was the section on how you need to drive these ground effect cars in order to extract maximum lap time from them. It was all stuff that I hadn't heard before. Thanks for your time, Alex. And I know I'm not alone in wishing you every success this year. It would be great to see you and Williams back on the podium at some point. So please send in your thoughts and stories about Alex and what you thought of this chat, as many of you did after last week's episode with Laurent Mekies. Laurent was really engaging, wasn't he? And I'm still interested in his belief that drivers can continue to get faster year on year and not just more rounded. As Koziol RH said, Laurent seems like a really interesting guy, and he's at least partially responsible for the halo, which makes me a fan. And that's the thing about Laurent Mekies. He's got so much experience across the board, not only in teams, and having all of that in his armory will make him a great team boss for RB. That's pretty much it for this episode. I will, of course, be back next week with another great guest from the world of Formula One. Let me remind you that F1 Nation's review of the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix is out now. We discuss Ollie Bearman's memorable Formula One debut and whether Max Verstappen would really consider leaving Red Bull. And why not check out the latest episode of F1 Explains with Susie Wolf and Leah Block talking all things F1 Academy. Thanks for listening. Please remember to send in your thoughts and stories about Alex Albon. But for now, Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audioboom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.